critical tasks with life or death outcomes. How can you know if an astronaut is ready? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is David F. Dinges, Ph.D., team leader of the National Space Biomedical Research Institute's Neurobehavioral and Psychosocial Factors Team. Dr. Dinges, thanks for taking a few minutes out to talk to our listeners today. First of all, tell us what this team is all about.
The team deals with brain and behavior issues in spaceflight. That is to say, the scientists working on the team, who are academics in different universities as well as NASA employees, are trying to identify ways to keep humans behaviorally healthy in spaceflight, to keep them functioning effectively as a group, that is, as a crew or a unit, and to make sure that they maintain their performance capability because of the incredible risks posed to an error, a performance error in spaceflight.
Now, this has been really in the news lately because obviously the Lisa Nowak issue a few months ago, and then more lately, there was a report in which apparently some NASA employees who were interviewed about spaceflight readiness said that they thought there were incidents where astronauts had been allowed to begin their missions under the influence of alcohol. NASA later dispelled that. But I guess my question is, we have been set up through the years by NASA, I think by design, to think of astronauts as somehow superhuman in the ability to keep emotions or physiological stress from affecting their cognitive and mental readiness for flight. Is that something that's kind of a little bit crashing down at this point?
Well, I don't know if it's quite as extreme as you stated. It is true that people attribute special capabilities to astronauts, and a lot of that is deserved because people who enter the Corps and are selected for flight are often remarkably fit, not only physiologically and physically, but behaviorally, psychologically, so that it is not a stretch to suggest that they are capable of withstanding remarkable physical and psychological stresses, given the risky work they do.
I guess the message then we should take from these recent news stories is that the kinds of factors which could make one less than fully ready for a mission are something that could happen to anyone.
I think that's a fair statement. In other words, spaceflight is so risky, and there are so many factors that play into it that can make demands on an individual that astronauts have to maintain a very high level of functional capability. And we know that there are things that can occur in spaceflight that can erode that functional capability, meaning long work hours, slam shifting, the practice of basically undergoing extreme jet lag repeatedly to try and line be awake at the time of a docking or a critical mission event, as well as the isolation, confinement, and just the fact that you're inches away from temperatures and vacuum that of space that can kill you immediately. And so those kinds of stresses and strains can take their toll, particularly when they're all occurring at once. And what we'd like to do, and by toll I mean they can actually lead to performance failures or mistakes, and that's what the astronauts would like to avoid, what NASA would like to avoid, and what the scientists working on this would like to avoid. That is to say, how can we help them know what their behavioral capability is and keep themselves ready at all times to be able to function at an optimum performance level?
Okay, now that objective brings us to NEMO, which takes place in Aquarius, which is a facility located near Key Largo, Florida. Tell us what Aquarius is and how it's used by NASA.
Well, I don't know everything about Aquarius, but I will tell you that it's a unique facility anchored on the ocean floor down about 60 feet off of Florida. The facility NASA uses periodically, so does the Navy and other agencies, allows them to simulate some of the aspects of spaceflight. The astronauts live below the surface in this structure mounted to the ocean floor, which is not much bigger than a spacecraft. It's very confined quarters. They leave the facility to do work out on in the sand on the ocean floor, and some of that simulates the partial gravity of the moon. Some of it simulates the mechanics and biomechanics and ergonomics of trying to build structures in that environment. Of course, there's a lethal risk here. They have to, be breathing oxygen, and they can't just surface immediately without having a risk from blood gas problems. So the crowdedness, the confinement, the risk to life, the simulation of partial gravity, the workload, dealing with mission control, all of that it occurs in NEMO, and therefore it has some of the analog environments of spaceflight. So when crews, astronaut crews work in NEMO, it's an opportunity for us to not only understand the forces that come to bear on them in terms of their ability to perform complex tasks, but also to try to find ways to make measurements on their ability to do that without being overly intrusive and with technologies and techniques that they find acceptable.
Now, a few moments ago, you mentioned something like jet lag, which would occur because your relationship to sunrise and sunset are messed up. I know if you're in a normal Earth orbit, typical of the space shuttle or the International Space Station, you're going to see a sunrise and a sunset like every 90 minutes or something like that. Do they try to simulate that with lights at the Aquarius facility?
Well, they have a schedule in which they're sleeping at night and working during the day. It could be a little bit off the normal land-based schedule, but by and large, it stays fairly similar to that. NEMO missions are also much shorter than spaceflight missions. They are typically somewhere between a week and 3 weeks, typically 8 to 12, 10 days, sometimes 17 days. And because of that, we do not see the kinds of severe circadian desynchronies that can occur in spaceflight, where, you, as you pointed out, you don't have the normal in training effects of sunrise and sunset on the circadian biology in the brain. But if in fact they flip their schedules and began working at night, biological night, and sleeping during daytime, they would in effect be experiencing what millions of Americans experience when they do night shift work or experience jet lag. And we know that those pose challenges to the brain's ability to perform at a high level, to think quickly, respond accurately, etc.
Tell us a little bit about the organization of the group within which you work and how it was able to interface with NASA to do this testing.
Well, the NSBRI, who we are all part of, is funded by NASA, and the team is made up of scientists in universities and at NASA. And the scientists are experts in different aspects of human behavior and biology. In this case, we have team members who are looking at group performance and functioning, simulating teams operating in simulated spaceflight environments, looking for what makes up a good team, a good coherent team that can solve problems even under heavy time pressure or duress. And some of us are looking at ways to monitor individuals as well as teams, but specific individual cognitive function and emotional status and stress levels in individual astronauts.
All right. Now, the psychomotor vigilance test, which involves reaction to a light signal, sounds like a very, very simple test.
It is the essence of simple.
Okay, now how is it developed, and what made it occur to somebody that this would be enough to get the measurement you needed?
Well, for years, and I mean literally going back nearly 30 years, my laboratory has been searching for ways to quickly and simply test a human and get a good sense of the integrity of the central nervous system. And we chose to target the attention system, sustained attention, the biology of which is early in cognition. That is, it's intimately connects the arousal system and alertness systems with the cognitive function systems, memory, and other systems. And we then looked for a way to measure it without the problems of aptitude and learning. In other words, it would be accurate regardless of how much education or aptitude you had, and it would be accurate regardless of whether you learned tasks quickly or slowly. And what we came up with was this psychomotor vigilance test. It is a brief test, and we're trying to make it ever briefer. The standard test is 10 minutes. We've worked it down to a 3-minute test that measures your reaction times to a light that is varying when it comes on. It captures pretty much all your attention has to be held on it. Any distractor will disrupt your performance. And then it measures your reaction time with a very high degree of accuracy, right down to a thousandth of a second. And then when we analyze aspects of that information that we get from it, of those reaction times, in a special way that allows us to understand what is happening to brain function, we can actually then detect when you're getting fatigued, when you haven't had enough sleep, whether you're up at night, whether you've just had a medication that's affecting you or sedating you, and a host of other things. And as a result of years of they're working on that for the in studies for the National Institutes of Health, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, and other agencies, including the Department of Transportation. We've been able to come up with a very short version of that that we're now testing with astronauts for NASA and the NSBRI.
Dr. Dinges, when we come back, I'd like to talk for a minute about some of the other applications of the psychomotor vigilance test. My guest is Dr. David Dinges of the National Space Biomedical Research Institute. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News. We'll be right back.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR-22 GTS, Cirrus's premium luxury ride that has come to define Cirrus aircraft as one of the world's elite. Every dream option from supple leather seats to an exhilarating 310 horsepower performance and speed come standard, giving new meaning to the phrase fully loaded. When flying the SR-22 GTS, getting there is truly more than half the fun. To learn more, call 888-750-9000 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design. Clarity Aloft headsets employ patented Comply Canal tips, composed of soft viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. More than simple earplugs, these foam tips provide full-spectrum noise reduction and outstanding attenuation. This advanced technology is lab-tested, proving that viscoelastic passive noise reduction is superior to active noise reduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack. My guest today is Dr. David F. Dinges of the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, who has developed with his colleagues a psychomotor vigilance test, which may be applied to astronauts to gauge their readiness for critical duties. Dr. Dinges, you mentioned that this test is effective regardless of someone's aptitude in taking it, but to some people this sounds like a reflex test, but this kind of reaction is not a reflex.
No, it isn't. In other words, this is an input-output measure. That is to say, it's not just how fast can you push a button. In fact, if you push the button too fast before the stimulus comes on and get a false start, those are errors of commission. And you see those things happen when someone is trying to game a system or hide impairment or other kinds of processes are active. We have a way with this system to track specifically your ability to hold very tightly your attention on something, respond the instant the stimulus comes on, and make that response as optimal as it can possibly be relative to the speed of your nervous system. That's all we're doing, but it turns out that that simple process of speed of the nervous system, input-output, is incredibly sensitive to a whole host of factors that can impair more complex human functioning.
Now, this is has obvious application for astronauts, and I don't think we need to go too deeply into that because it's been in the news quite a bit. Some of the most interesting commentary I've heard about this device is its potential applications elsewhere. I think in particular of someone who has been sentenced by a court after a drinking and driving incident to have one of these machines hooked up to their car where they have to blow into the tube before the car will start. This sounds like it would be a much simpler technology to implement to do a job like that.
Well, it's an interesting question you raise. Historically, fitness for duty tests or impairment tests have focused on physiologic measures like the amount of alcohol in your breath, breath alcohol analysis or in your urine. In an effort to get away from that, there's been a push towards performance measures, but many of them suffer from these problems of aptitude and learning. So yes, you're correct. A simple test like this, if it can be shown to be very sensitive and valid in its specificity, could be quite useful. One of the weaknesses of the tests are, that includes this test, one cannot always know what the factor was that caused the impairment on the test. Now, with astronauts or highly controlled environments, we can get a pretty good idea based on our knowledge of what else is happening in the spaceship and the spacecraft and what else they might be doing, their work schedules and that. But for the average person off the street being given a test like this, you might detect impairment, which we think we can do, but you might not know what it was due to. Maybe they didn't get enough sleep last night. Maybe they had alcohol. Future tests that we're looking at, including variations on this one, will try to get the specificity specificity of the test higher. Right now, we focused heavily on sensitivity, but once we can make it very specific so we know that alcohol looks different from something else, then we're going to have a real head start in being able to use performance like this to detect what's wrong with people specifically. And in fact, we have been able, for example, to discriminate the effects of motion sickness from the effects of sleep loss with the test we currently have.
All right, here's a very pointed question then, and this maybe getting into some sociological issues and even political issues, but if a test cannot distinguish between alcohol abuse and sleep deprivation and just having had a fight with your wife, do the people on the road who are sharing the road with you really care? Should that person be behind the wheel regardless?
Well, you're right. That's a sociologic question. You know, these are policy questions. It's an area that we also work in, and I have to tell you that societies as a whole struggle with these questions enormously. How does one define impairment? And in fact, over the years, we've made our highways safer so that more impaired drivers can operate on them by putting in wider lanes and shoulder rumble strips and jersey barriers and seat belts, active and passive restraints. But we're constantly struggling with should people who voluntarily impair themselves or impaired by disease or illness or by certain behaviors be allowed to do certain things, work certain kinds of machinery, etc. And in some cases, we make those decisions. For example, airline pilots, we have fairly strict rules about when they can have alcohol and etc. relative to their work time. But by and large, for so many of us, those rules are relatively liberal and do not apply. And then we have a terrible problem of enforcing them. So, for example, with sleep deprivation, we've got so many sleepy people on the road, or cell phone use. We've got so many people using cell phones that it's probably not realistic to expect that we could enforce removing or testing every person we suspect is impaired from one of those two factors on the road or is not driving safely. So what we need is different approaches to educating people how the risks posed by these things, better technologies for preventing an impaired person from operating in certain ways, etc. But it is a broader social and economic issue.
Probably much more likely to see it in airplanes at some point than we would in automobiles, right?
Yeah, I think so, and that's partly, although the automobile industry is moving very rapidly towards detecting impairment, and one of the things, in addition to this PBT test, we're also working on teaching computers to read the human face, and we've done work for the Department of Transportation tracking driver behavior, and we've been able to show, for example, if you can track the speed of slow eyelid closures, you can get a very highly accurate estimate of the likelihood of someone lapsing behind the wheel or falling asleep, and I think we're going to see motor vehicle manufacturers, once the public wants these technologies, quickly unveil a variety of ways to know whether your driver's impaired. And your motor vehicle, I think, in the not-too-distant future, will talk to you, just as your GPS does now when you drive, and it'll say, you know, David, wake up. You're really very drowsy. Why don't you get off down the road? There's an exit in 2 miles, and there's a place you may be able to get some coffee or a nap. And I think that day is very close.
Oh, that's amazing. Only she won't say it as cleanly as you did. She'll have that robotic voice.
Well, it probably depends on what you pay for your car. I noticed that one of my cars is rude and the other one's quite polite.
Okay. Well, before we go, let me ask you about the cortisol test, because cortisol has been in a lot of sort of, well, I don't want to call them shady, but not necessarily strongly scientifically backed advertising lately. What is cortisol and why are you measuring it in these tests?
Well, cortisol is a hormone, a metabolic steroid hormone produced by the adrenal glands as a function of activity in the brain from the hypothalamus to the pituitary gland to the adrenals around the kidneys. It is a kind of activation hormone. It's the hormone, one of the hormones that's active and secreted by our body biologically in a timed manner in about halfway through our sleep so that it peaks in the morning when we wake up. It's a kind of get up, get out of bed, get going hormone. But it's fairly toxic to the nervous system, and therefore the brain has a lot of ways to shut it off quickly. The misuse or the use or misuse of the word cortisol or cortisone or claims about cortisol and weight gain and things like that, I don't have any comment on, except to say that, as you suggested, one needs to be careful about these kind of claims relative to the science. We study it in astronauts because it's also widely recognized in psychology and behavioral science to be a stress hormone. That is to say, if I suddenly said, you need to stand up and give a speech, and you weren't expecting to do so, you'll usually have a great big pulse of cortisol released into your brain, into your bloodstream, which will affect your brain. And that's the fight or flight response, the activation response of the body to a stressor or unpredictable event. We're interested in using it that way to identify whether astronauts are having any of those reactions while they're in NEMO and ultimately while they're in space. And the nice thing is we no longer have to put a needle in you to get blood to look at it. We can literally take, all you have to do is give us a little bit of saliva and we can ask say it and measure your cortisol.
You know, I also have reason to believe this would have application in FAA check rides and blind dates.
Well, I'll leave it to our listeners to think of all the ways they might want to use it. But in one sense, there's a seriousness to what you said. As all of these technologies get simpler, smaller, quicker, more valid, more reliable, more specific, it poses a whole set of questions around how should we use them, and in what ways are the ethical and legal ways? What are the safe ways? How can we improve society? And what are the abusive, inappropriate ways to use them? For example, you wouldn't want to use a technology that warned you when you were falling asleep driving to keep driving with the false belief that the device will keep you awake. Mm-hmm. We know that doesn't work. So I think no matter how good we are scientifically with invention of technologies for tracking humans and understanding biology and its role in behavior, we are still never free from the fundamental ethical, legal questions around and social questions around how to use something in a responsible manner.
Dr. David F. Dinges is with the National Space Biomedical Research Institute. And, Doctor, we really appreciate your taking a few minutes out for our listeners today, and we will keep in touch.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a special feature from AeroNews. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.